The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You're listening to DNA ID, brought to you by Abject Entertainment. Be sure to check out some of the other great true crime podcasts from this network, including The Murder in My Family, Missing Persons, Scene of the Crime, Three Men and a Mystery, Malice, Riddle Me That, All Things Crime, and Zodiac Speaking. All of these podcasts are available for you to binge on right now, wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe where you're listening to this podcast so you don't miss an episode.
Episode 6, Tracy Hammerberg. It was 1984. December in Wisconsin is cold, and this winter was no different. Snow lay on the ground, the sky was gray, and bitter wind kept most people indoors. But not 18-year-old Tracy Hammerberg. Like many young people, Tracy was full of life, and on a cold and wintry Friday night, December 14th, she went out. On the morning of Saturday, December 15th, a man named Dan Saraki set out to get the newspaper in the dim dawn light down his very long, curved, private driveway at 2300 Maple Road. And about halfway down, around the curve toward Maple Road, he discovered a shocking sight. A partially clothed, bloodied young woman lay on her back in the fresh snow on the frozen gravel driveway. This was in rural Grafton, 20 miles north of Milwaukee. Dan Saraki thought he could hear her faintly breathing. The Ozaukee County Sheriff's Office responded to Saraki's panicked 6:27 a.m. call, dispatching a deputy to the house. When he arrived at 6:36, he found Saraki next to a dead young woman, naked from the waist down, save her red socks, lying on the bloodstained snow. Her hair was matted with blood and brain tissue, and her face and neck showed bruising. Her blue jeans and shoes lay near her head, both soaked in blood. Her green sweater, long green jacket, and scarf were pulled up, exposing her breasts. There was no identification on the body. In a sign of the times, the deputy removed a wool blanket from the trunk of his squad car and placed it over the dead young woman to shield her from prying eyes, something that today would be seen as destructive to crime scene evidence. The body was collected and taken to the medical examiner's office for processing. Detectives began trying to establish the identity of the young woman, and they had a few clues to go on. She was white, had reddish-brown hair, and a tattoo on her right wrist. They had a spark of hope when they identified the large sapphire signet ring on her left ring finger as a class ring with the name Glenn on it. But the ring was from a Bowdoin High School, class of 83, and there was not a high school with that name in the entire state of Wisconsin. In fact, it was from a high school in North Dakota. And there were no missing persons reports matching the description of the victim on the table at the ME's office. Meanwhile, by midday on Saturday, Tracy Hammerberg's mother was beginning to fret that Tracy had not come home on Friday night. As far as she knew, her daughter had gone on a babysitting job and then had been planning on going to a Christmas party. She had never returned home, but that was not that unusual for Tracy, who had lots of friends and was in and out of the house often. But on Saturday night, Jennifer, Tracy's much younger half-sister, was watching The Muppet Show when a breaking news flash came on the screen announcing a murder of an unidentified young woman that would be on the 10 o'clock news. Vicious murders were very rare in the area, and this was big news. It's hard to imagine Judy's horror when, already anxious, she saw the news report that the body of a young woman had been found in Grafton. Her husband set out with a photo of Tracy to show around in some local bars to see if anyone had seen the teen. Meanwhile, Judy called the Ozaukee County Sheriff's Office and hesitantly queried whether the victim could be her daughter. She told authorities that her daughter Tracy was 5'4", 115 pounds, with dyed reddish-brown hair and had a heart-shaped tattoo on her wrist. The clincher, she was wearing a blue stone class ring from her boyfriend, who lived in North Dakota. Even though Jennifer was only 6 at the time, she recalls a flurry of phone calls and being sent to a neighbor's house to stay out of her parents' way. Robert, Tracy's stepfather, had to go and identify Tracy's body on Sunday morning. None of the family could fathom who could have done this to their beloved sister and daughter. Tracy's autopsy, conducted at 6 p.m. on Saturday, determined that she died of massive head injuries. Her body was terribly battered. She had bruising on her neck and petechiae that led the medical examiner to conclude that she had been strangled. A large bruise on her chest suggested that someone wearing a boot had stomped on her sternum and pinned her down. She had been bludgeoned to death, the right side of her head bashed in with a hard object that was metal-based, like a baseball bat or tire iron, but no weapon was found at the scene, and she had been sexually assaulted. The large amount of semen found in Tracy's vaginal canal indicated that she had been raped nearly simultaneously with her death, and injuries consistent with a violent rape were noted on her body in vaginal and anal tearing. Biological evidence was collected from Tracy's body in the form of semen and in blood scraped from under her fingernails. This was holdback information at the time, but Tracy had fought back hard. She had not been bound and had been able to try to defend herself from what was probably a surprise attack. She had quite a bit of someone else's blood under the fingernails of her right hand, leading investigators to believe that the person who attacked and raped her and the person who killed her were one and the same. The whole thing had gone down shortly before Dan Saraki found her lying in his driveway. Saraki, a Korean War veteran, was familiar with the sounds a dying person's last breaths make, and he was certain that he had heard them coming from Tracy. She had died just as help was on the way. Let's talk a little bit about Tracy. Tracy L. Hammerberg was born in Milwaukee on March 7, 1966, to parents Harlan Hammerberg and Judy Klebund. Her parents divorced in 1969, and her mother remarried Robert Lubke. Tracy and her mom, stepdad, older brother Rick, and half-sister Jennifer moved to the home on Mayfair Drive in Saukville 4 years earlier because her stepdad Robert said life in Milwaukee was getting too rough and they wanted someplace safer. Robert told the Sheboygan Press after Tracy's murder, quote, "It just didn't dawn on us that this sort of thing could happen here." Tracy's sister lived in Nebraska with Harlan Hammerberg, her and Tracy's father, and by the time Tracy was killed, Rick had also moved out of the house. Tracy had a bit of a rough time of it in her high school years, and she ended up dropping out of Port Washington High in May of her junior year, despite several counselors attempting to dissuade her from this path. She had a few run-ins with police on a couple of occasions where she ran away, which, she told her friends, was because her stepfather had been making advances to her. She had also received counseling from the Ozaukee County Social Services Department on several occasions over the previous 3 years for drug and alcohol abuse. Tracy had spent a short period in a group home and, on her 18th birthday, had moved out of her parents' home and lived at the Wilson House in downtown Port Washington. She moved in a lot of different social circles, and some of them involved teens who were involved in the drug scene and were familiar to local law enforcement. But by December of 1984, when she was killed, Tracy was pulling herself together. She was working as a babysitter, back living at home, and was planning on an imminent move to North Dakota to live with and work with her boyfriend, Glenn, whose ring she was wearing as a sign of their mutual commitment. Tracy was portrayed in the media as a bit of a partier, but her family, friends, and some people she babysat for say she was much more than that. She was described as very friendly, caring, a people pleaser. Friendly and popular, she moved easily between different groups of people. She was energetic and easygoing, although people who knew her say she was not always happy. She loved animals and hoped to maybe work with them one day. The investigation got underway. Initially, authorities didn't know if Tracy had been killed where she was found or dumped after being beaten. But crime scene techs would answer that question when they discovered blood cast off splattered on trees near the body. And a tire impression visible in the snow along Dan Saraki's driveway told investigators that the girl had been driven to that location in someone's vehicle and beaten where she lay. An open pack of Marlboro Reds lying near Tracy's feet was collected and bagged. Inquiries told investigators that Tracy smoked menthols. These cigarettes likely belonged to her killer. Right where Tracy's body lay was a signpost that had the Saraki name on it and the name of the hollow the property was named after. Investigators wondered if this was some sort of message from the killer. Surprisingly, neighbors near the Sarakis had not heard a thing, but a few people were up and about on that very early Saturday morning and reported seeing something. One was a man preparing to go hunting at 5:45 a.m. Out his window, he saw a dark-colored, mid-sized sedan speeding away from the direction of the Sarakis with the headlights off. A second witness was a female neighbor of the Sarakis who reported to police that she had observed a man in a green pickup truck idling in the area around dawn. Police tracked down the truck, which turned out to have been a hunter, who had left his truck running while he was walking in the woods nearby. He, too, had seen something. He heard squealing tires and saw a dark, mid-sized sedan speeding north on Maple Road with its lights off. Based on these reports about the speeding car at 5:45 a.m., and the fact that Dan Saraki had called the Ozaukee County Sheriff just before 6:30, it seemed to investigators that Tracy had not been lying in the snow for very long when she was found. Sheriff's Department officials observed that the area of Maple Road where Tracy was found was remote, off the beaten path, and would not be the kind of place anyone but a local would know. But Tracy was familiar with it. Some of the Saraki young adults were involved in the same party scene as Tracy, and their social circles overlapped. She had almost certainly been to the house in the past, and even though it was technically located in Grafton, it was near the town line and just 2 miles from Tracy's own home in Saukville. Investigators started to believe that whoever killed Tracy had been someone she knew. She was known to hitchhike, but her family felt that she would be more likely to accept a ride from an acquaintance than a total stranger. Police formed a theory that someone had offered Tracy a ride and things went very wrong, and they had an idea where to look. Investigators had put together a timeline of Tracy's last known activities. That Friday night started out at 7:20 p.m. with Tracy babysitting for the Michaels family in the village of Saukville where she lived, population about 4,000. Mrs. Michaels asked Tracy to come back the next morning at 7:30 a.m. After leaving the Michaels house at 9:45 p.m., Tracy walked to an S&S Foods, which was a convenience store at the intersection of Tower Street and Highway 33 in Saukville, to meet up with her friends Matt D. and Scott M. The trio drove to Quade's Tavern in Port Washington, where Tracy purchased a six-pack of beer. At the pub, Tracy told the bartender that she was planning on going to a party in Grafton that night. But the group's next stop was actually Matt's house on Garfield Street in Port Washington, 5 miles from Quade's Tavern. There, it wasn't so much a party as a small gathering of friends doing what teenagers do. Tracy and 5 or 6 guys played some drinking games and smoked a little pot. After that, Tracy's trail went cold. Investigators were told by one male friend of Tracy's that she had gone to a late-night drug party in Grafton and left that party with 3 men, but investigators could never find any confirmation of this. Police rounded up the male friends they knew had definitely been with Tracy that night, Matt and Scott. They each confirmed in separate interviews that they had been at the tavern with Tracy and then at Matt's with some other teen boys where they had played drinking games and hung out. Matt's older brother David arrived home from work around midnight. Soon afterwards, David and Scott left to make a run to S&S Foods to play video games and grab a snack. David said that he offered Tracy a ride home, but she said no, she would walk. When David and Scott left in Scott's car, Tracy stayed at the house with Matt and a guy named Steve, and they told investigators that Tracy had left the house on foot around 12:30 a.m. So, the young men all told investigators the same version of a similar story, that Tracy left Matt and David's house around 12:30 on foot to make the 3.7-mile walk home along Wisconsin Highway 33, which ran in part between Port Washington and Saukville. She was alone. The 2-lane highway at the time ran through a largely undeveloped area, was very dark at night, and was not intended for pedestrian traffic. It was a walk Tracy had made many times in the past, but this time she never made it to her house. Of course, since Tracy was last known to be at a house party with a bunch of drunk young men, and the specific details of their recollections of the evening varied, police were suspicious. For example, Scott, who was only 16 and who admitted that he had driven Tracy to Matt's house that night, told 2 different stories about where he had left his car that evening. His initial story was that he went home that night and parked his car in the garage. But in a follow-up interview, he said he left his car in Matt's driveway overnight. Someone could have used it, he said, and he was missing a key to it. The entire thing seems somewhat shady to investigators. In the vast majority of crimes, the most logical, simple explanation provides the right answer. And in this case, it was hard to believe that these boys had nothing to do with what happened to Tracy. That Tracy would have left the party on her own to walk home nearly 4 miles so late at night in the freezing winter weather, and someone just happened upon her and killed her in such a brutal fashion, just defied belief. Tracy's sister Lori says that she, for one, was certain something had happened to her sister at Matt's house that night. There was more. Investigators discovered that after word got out that there had been a fresh tire track found at the scene where Tracy's body lay, Scott had changed the tires on his vehicle. This was a major red flag. All three young men were brought back in for additional questioning, and David, Matt's older brother, alarmed investigators with his story. He said he had gotten a flat tire on the way home from work that Friday night, driving home from Milwaukee. Remember, he got home around midnight, the boys had said. David said he changed the flat tire, but now he couldn't find his tire iron. Ding, ding, ding. You'll recall that the autopsy report posited that the murder weapon could have been a tire iron. Police could not have come up with a better suspect if they had tried than a young man who was among the last known people to see Tracy alive, admitted he had offered her a ride, and who had suddenly misplaced the very item believed to have killed her. And they latched onto David as prime suspect number one. Crime techs processed David's car, but no evidence found in the vehicle connected him to Tracy. Of course, detectives believe that's why he had gotten rid of the tire iron. They collected a blood sample from David to compare to the blood type found under Tracy's nails. And his blood type was not a match to that found at the crime scene. Something you should know about the blood type of the unknown offender, it was a very rare blood type. In fact, only 2.5% of the male population has it. It was type O blood, but with two identifiable enzymes that made it extremely rare. It was much easier to rule people out than if the sample had been from someone with generic type O blood. And David did not have this rare blood type. Neither did Matt or Scott. Investigators had to cross them off their list. Some of them remained convinced that the young men were hiding something, but since they could find no evidence of their involvement, investigators just had to side-eye these guys as possible suspects, but could not act on their suspicions. But then another, even more promising suspect would soon emerge. The Ozaukee County Sheriff's Office received a tip that would change the direction of the case, at least temporarily. A woman called in and said that she was the girlfriend of a man named Dale Schultz. Schultz was a guy who had become known to law enforcement in the area because of his multiple domestic violence incidents. The girlfriend was calling because she had seen the story about Tracy Hammerberg's murder on the news, and she had some concerns about her boyfriend. The first was that he had showed up at her house on Saturday morning, the morning when Tracy was found, and asked her to wash a bloody jacket. He said he had gotten into a bar fight and the jacket was spattered and smeared. And Schultz worked in a local garage and would easily have had access to tire irons and similar implements. But even more importantly, he had dated Tracy Hammerberg. Needless to say, investigators were intrigued. They picked Dale up for questioning. He confirmed that he knew Tracy. The two met in a bar. Dale told them that on Friday night, December 14th, he had been at a tavern in Grafton with friends. Some of his friends said he left around 1 a.m., but others weren't so sure. Old Dale didn't exactly have an ironclad alibi. And the bar he had been hanging out at was along the route Tracy would have taken to walk home. Investigators suspected that Dale had been driving and had come across Tracy. Since they had a history, perhaps she willingly accepted a ride from him. Dale didn't set their minds at ease in his response to this question. He said, "If I did do it, I don't remember doing it." And the clincher? Dale's blood sample showed that his blood type was a match to the type found under Tracy's fingernails, the rare type that only 2.5% of the male population had. Dale Schultz became prime suspect number one. Honestly, at this point, it's amazing that they didn't lock Dale up and throw away the key. I'm certain people have been convicted on less evidence. But prosecutors weren't comfortable with only a 97.5% likelihood that Dale was their man. He hadn't confessed, no one saw him with Tracy, and there was no evidence that she was ever in his vehicle. Dale was released on his own recognizance while they built a case, and he immediately split town and hightailed it to Colorado, where he continued to have violent encounters with women in his life. He remained, in the minds of investigators, the best candidate for the murderer of Tracy that they had come across, but they did not have enough to proceed with an indictment.
In Puerto Rico, we call ourselves Boricua. We are proud, passionate, and full of life. On our island, adventure finds you. Strangers aren't strangers for long. The size of the audience doesn't change the beauty of the music. And we celebrate every last ray of sun. Live Boricua.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Investigators continued to rule out scores of potential suspects using blood type comparison testing. Then, in July 1985, without any viable suspects in Tracy's case having been identified after 7 months, there was another murder. And this murder had startling similarities to Tracy's case. A partially clothed, partially decomposed young woman was found dead on a wooded hillside overlooking Port Washington, near the fire station and the steps that go up to the top of Lookout Point. She was discovered by two Milwaukee residents who were in Port Washington for the town's annual Fish Day festivities. Like Tracy, this young woman was nude from the waist down. As we know, Tracy was in Port Washington on the night she died. And there was more. The victim's name was Wendy Smith. She was 18 years old, and she was a good friend and high school classmate of Tracy's. In fact, Tracy's mom told the media that Tracy and Wendy had often attended the same parties and hung with the same crowd. Not only that, Wendy was one of the many people interviewed in connection with Tracy's murder investigation. Wendy was reported missing on Saturday, July 20th, after her family had not seen her since Thursday. She had last been seen walking between a friend's home and a downtown tavern where her mother worked, sometime around 1 a.m. on Friday morning. The coroner determined that the bruised young woman had been strangled to death and sexually assaulted, and her case was classified as a homicide. Investigators were not sure where Wendy had been killed because the hillside where she was dumped was covered with brush. It was believed that she had been dead for 24 hours before she was found. Her time of death was believed to have been sometime on July 19th. As would be expected, investigators immediately considered the possibility that Tracy's and Wendy's cases were connected. It was just too coincidental that two good friends, the same age and who knew many of the same people, were both murdered on a Friday, mere months apart, and dumped in the same general area. Port Washington police teamed up with Ozaukee County investigators to look into any connection. Port Washington Police Chief Edward Rudolph Jr. said he would be interviewing many of the same people as were talked to in Tracy's case. And, in fact, over the next months, it was reported that investigators spoke to over 1,000 people in Wendy's case, and, of course, they were still working Tracy's case. The FBI's Behavioral Analysis Unit put together a profile of the killer, which posited that he was a loner, someone who hovered on the fringes of the social scene, and who had a criminal record for lesser crimes. Behind the scenes, though, authorities began to doubt whether the two murders were related after all. There were some forensic differences and disparities in the way the two young women were killed that were kept under wraps at the time. One of these was that Wendy's assault was committed by a particularly depraved individual. She had been bitten by her attacker. He had left visible bite marks on her body, one in particular on her right breast that would be his downfall. While Tracy's case languished, in February 1986, an arrest was announced in Wendy's case. 22-year-old Thomas M. Kirsch of Port Washington was charged with first-degree murder. Police honed in on him because of his unique bite pattern, which exactly matched the bite on Wendy's breast. This was per a forensic odontologist, one of only 60 in the country at the time, named L. Thomas Johnson, who had analyzed the bite patterns and Kirsch's dental impressions. The bite mark on Wendy showed a unique tooth array with one tooth completely turned around and facing the wrong way in the palate. Now, listeners will have the same question I had, which is, how the heck did police get hold of some random guy's bite patterns to compare to those on the victim? They must have been looking at him as a suspect already, right? Well, they were. Kirsch was an ex-boyfriend of Wendy's, a guy described as a weirdo who had a history of drug use. According to the expert Dr. Johnson, he had been the one to bite Wendy. After questioning, Kirsch admitted only to walking around with Wendy on the night she was killed. Kirsch was described by many people who knew him as quiet, a loner, gentle. The parents of his 17-year-old girlfriend, who was 7 months pregnant with Kirsch's child when he was arrested, said that they did not believe he could have killed anyone. Several people recounted that Kirsch tended to sit in one spot and stare into space for long periods of time. While Thomas Kirsch was facing charges for killing Wendy Smith, investigators were trying to decide whether he was a good suspect in Tracy's case, and they found out that they had significant reason to consider him a person of interest. Kirsch and Tracy had had a run-in in May 1984 that had resulted in Kirsch being sentenced to a year of probation for criminal trespass and property damage charges. This per the Journal, quote, "According to the complaint in that case, Kirsch broke into a Port Washington apartment occupied by Hammerberg and another woman, cursed, pulled the telephone receiver out of Hammerberg's hand as she tried to call the police, and then pulled the telephone cord out of the wall." It seems that Kirsch had something going on with the friend of Tracy's, the other young woman in the apartment. But of course, since investigators knew he had killed Wendy Smith, he moved up the suspect list in Tracy's case. But just as quickly, he was eliminated as a suspect. Investigators determined that at the time Tracy was murdered, Kirsch was confined in the Cephas Halfway House in Waukesha. Two bed checks on the night of December 14th to 15th, 1984, confirmed his presence at the facility. It's not clear why Kirsch was admitted to the halfway house in the first place, but his alibi was impenetrable. Kirsch had not killed Tracy. This meant, of course, that there were two separate men out there who had attacked, raped, and brutally slain two young friends, totally independently of one another, mere months apart. Kirsch was initially found incompetent to stand trial, but that decision was reversed after a few months of psychiatric evaluations, and Kirsch stood trial. He was found guilty of the first-degree murder of Wendy Smith, even though the judge acknowledged that the 22-year-old was suffering from a mental disease when he killed Wendy. Kirsch was sentenced to life in prison in June 1987 and has bounced back and forth between prison and the state mental health facility ever since. As of 2020, he was housed at the Winnebago Mental Health Institute. Interestingly, his court-appointed attorney, Gerald Boyle, who described Kirsch as a very sick young man, went on to represent Jeffrey Dahmer, another very sick young man. Okay, so Wendy Smith's death had nothing to do with Tracy Hammerberg's. Despite the odds of there being two predators murdering two connected young women of the same age in the same area in the same time period, as we shall see in a moment, Thomas Kirsch was not Tracy's killer. After Wendy's case was resolved in 1987 with the conviction of Thomas Kirsch, Tracy's case went cold for over two decades. Although investigators continued to work it quietly behind the scenes, there was no progress on the case for several years. The first breakthrough was in 1995 when new DNA technology facilitated the development of a DNA profile of Tracy's killer from the semen and blood evidence found on her body. Once CODIS was established, the male profile was entered with no success. Investigators re-ran the profile in CODIS monthly for decades without any hits. Then in 2005, then Ozaukee County Sheriff's Office Detective Jim Johnson took on the case, familiarized himself with it, and vowed to see it through. He had a personal interest in Tracy's unsolved murder. Johnson had grown up in the area, attended Port Washington High, and knew many of those involved in the investigation. For example, Thomas Kirsch was his next-door neighbor growing up. Along with his partner, Wisconsin Department of Justice, Department of Criminal Investigations Special Agent Neil McGrath, Johnson reviewed the entire case file from start to finish. And the two investigators decided to revisit the original trio of suspects, the boys from the party. They weren't satisfied that investigators in the 80s had gotten the whole truth about when they last saw Tracy from these now 50-plus-year-old men. If you recall, Scott had told two different stories about where his car was parked that night and had implied that someone could have used it. And the tire replacement thing was suspect. And when they questioned him this time around, investigators got an incredibly lucky break. Scott still owned the same vehicle. It was sitting in his yard, rusted out and beat up, waiting to be tested. Johnson and McGrath could not help but wonder if Scott had held on to the car for all these years to keep evidence of a crime under his own control. When investigators asked Scott if they could take the car in for processing, he refused. They had to obtain a warrant to impound and search the vehicle. They discovered that the front seats had been removed and disposed of, very suspicious. Johnson felt strongly that they had the vehicle that Tracy had gotten into that night and suffered her fate at the hands of her killer. Scott deepened their suspicions by asking for immunity if they found anything. It really seemed that either he had done something to Tracy in the car or knew that someone else had. When the crime lab processed the car, they found a microscopic bloodstain in the back seat, human blood. If it was Tracy's blood, the physical evidence tying Scott and his crew to her murder would be undeniable. But the sample found in the car was too minute to permit testing to determine whose blood it was. More than 30 years had passed since Tracy's murder, and DNA testing technology had come a long, long way. And even though they still did not have any answers in Tracy's case, Johnson and McGrath knew that the one thing they did have was DNA. They had developed a single, consistent male profile from the seminal fluid collected from Tracy and some of the fingernail scrapings from her right hand. And they started testing pretty much everyone against this DNA profile. Investigators obtained DNA from Scott, Matt, and David and ran it against that found on Tracy. None of them were a match. Sheriff Johnson said that he believed the best suspect remained Dale Schultz, the one who beat up women, had blood on him the night Tracy was killed, had no alibi, and had the same rare blood type as the killer. So they got his DNA too, and were honestly stunned when he was also not a match. He was cleared. They went on to use the DNA profile to eliminate literally hundreds of men. Investigators contacted and swabbed anyone who they believed could have come in contact with Tracy. Her boyfriend Glenn, her stepfather, her friend Troy, Dan Siraki, who had found Tracy, and the male members of his family, all were cleared. The Siraki men were on police radar in a big way because they knew Tracy, and of course she had been found on their remote property. But now, after decades of living under suspicion, they too were eliminated. Some people in the community volunteered to have their DNA tested in response to a request from investigators. Others refused and had to be served with search warrants for their DNA. They tried to connect with and test friends of friends, acquaintances, and local men who were of the right age when the murder occurred. Now Sheriff Jim Johnson said the 400-plus tests they conducted is the largest number of DNA tests conducted in one case in the entire state of Wisconsin. But it all came to nothing. Tracy's photo continued to hang in the Ozaukee County Sheriff's offices. Jim Johnson and his colleagues were borderline obsessed with solving her case. In 2018, Johnson became Ozaukee County Sheriff. By 2019, Ozaukee County investigators had resigned themselves that they could not solve Tracy's case using traditional detective work. And several of the sheriff's office personnel had heard about the Golden State Killer case being solved using forensic genealogy and had even completed personal DNA testing kits themselves. Anxious for resolution, they reached out to the FBI's forensic genealogy team who had worked on GSK and were surprised how amenable the team was to working on Tracy's case. The problem? They needed a new DNA profile of the killer. The DNA profile that is entered into CODIS is of a different type, showing different markers than the DNA used for forensic genealogy. Ozaukee investigators now had a team willing to help them with the genealogical research, but they needed a raw DNA sample. And because of the historic levels of testing they had done with over 400 people compared to the DNA in Tracy's case, they had used it all up. There was a temporary setback when investigators feared that their hopes would be dashed. But then, after ransacking the evidence stores, they found a fresh vial left over from previous tests of biological material taken at Tracy's autopsy and carefully preserved over the previous decades. They hadn't even realized that this vial existed. But now, the day was saved. They submitted the material to Gene by Gene in Texas, the parent company of Family Tree DNA, which conducts this type of testing. And in April 2019, they were able to deliver a profile suitable for forensic genealogy to the FBI's team. Researchers uploaded the profile to Family Tree DNA. The results were overwhelming. A second cousin of the killer was identified, which meant that tracers, with the assistance of special computer software, had to go back four generations to establish the family tree of the killer and determine which persons could be their man. There were hundreds of candidates. Using some parameters to narrow down the list, men who were aged 16 to 60 in 1984, men who were in the Ozaukee area, still left them with scores of names to either eliminate or investigate. It was a daunting task that took months. They divided the family trees for different investigators to pursue different branches, assisted by genealogist Barbara Ray Venter and the FBI team. Just as they had been about to give up on one of the branches, as it was leading nowhere, the FBI analyst Melissa Parisseau had an inkling that they were missing something. Sure enough, further digging revealed a second marriage that had been missed. A female ancestor of the killer, a fairly close relative, had married a second husband and born children. And from this previously unknown branch were descendants that led directly to two local brothers. They had arrived at the names of the two possible suspects after lots of boots-on-the-ground investigative work that involved staking out some members of the family to grab a discarded item to test their DNA. This was because they did not want to alert people to the path they were going down. The surreptitious testing helped them eliminate some and narrow down their focus. Then, as they got closer, they contacted two female relatives of their suspects and requested DNA samples, which were willingly given. Interestingly, they requested this help from women because it was felt that they would be more likely to cooperate than men. And after 5 months of investigative work, the additional testing led them to brothers Eugene and Philip Cross. Neither was a name familiar to Tracy's investigators. They started with Philip Cross. This was because of the two brothers, he was the one with a criminal record. And they were right. On August 28, 2019, the investigative team confirmed definitively, based on the DNA, that Philip J. Cross was the killer of Tracy Hammerberg. A press conference was held in October informing the public of the conclusion of the Tracy Hammerberg investigation. Tracy's killer, Philip Cross, had died of an overdose at age 48 on August 21, 2012. He had been found unresponsive in a seedy motel on Milwaukee's northwest side, the Diamond Inn, with a crack pipe and needle close at hand. But investigators had been able to identify him definitively as the killer of Tracy Hammerberg because, pursuant to regular protocols, Cross's autopsy had included collection of a DNA card, so there was a permanent record of his DNA. The DNA had never been tested for anything. It was sitting in a file in the Milwaukee County Medical Examiner's office. Neil McGrath obtained it, and the state crime lab ran the comparison to find the match. Cross's name never appeared in the massive Tracy Hammerberg case file. Let's take a look at Philip Cross and the synchronicities between him and Tracy that resulted in her murder. Cross was born on October 28, 1963. In 1984, he was 21 years old. He was living with his parents on Green Bay Road in Port Washington, and he had grown up in the area. He had briefly attended Port Washington High in 1978, possibly even overlapping with Tracy. But he was expelled and sent to a reformatory school after calling in a bomb threat to the high school and stealing a car. Ethan Allen School, where Cross would spend the next couple of years, was a school for wayward kids housed in a former sanatorium in Delafield, Wisconsin, that was closed permanently in 2011. In a 1978 interview with police after the car theft incident, Cross admitted that on occasion he did things without realizing at the time what he was doing. Never a good sign. Cross's time at Ethan Allen was a bit rocky. He went missing on three occasions while at the school before being permanently released in August of 1981. In 1982, Cross landed in the Ozaukee County Jail on drug and related charges. He cooperated with investigators and even turned informant, feeding the cops information on local drug dealers. But any brownie points he may have earned weren't enough to keep him out of hot water. Cross's anger issues and violent tendencies would lead to decades of criminal behavior.
In Puerto Rico, we call ourselves Boricua. We are proud, passionate, and full of life. On our island, adventure finds you. Strangers aren't strangers for long. The size of the audience doesn't change the beauty of the music. And we celebrate every last ray of sun. Live Boricua.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
In 1983, Cross was arrested after punching a hole in the wall of the Driftwood Motel in connection with an argument with his girlfriend at the time. Then he was convicted of forgery and spent more than a year in the Wisconsin state prison system from February 1983 to April 1984. At that time, he was released from Dodge Correctional Institution and moved in with his parents in Port Washington, and in September landed a job at Rex Nord Plastics in Grafton. He was out of prison only 3 months when he killed Tracy. Investigators in 2019 were more than a little surprised to find out that Cross's employment records at Rex Nord Plastics were still intact. They reflected that he worked second shift, and on Friday, December 14th, from 4 p.m. to midnight, he was at work. His whereabouts at the time Tracy was believed to have gone missing were unaccounted for. Further, RMV records showed that in 1984 and 85, Cross was driving a 1972 Plymouth Fury, a dark sedan consistent with that described by the two hunters in the Syracuse neighborhood. After he killed Tracy, Cross stayed out of trouble for a while, but his track record at work at Rex Nord was not good. He was the subject of multiple complaints from his coworkers. He was cited for leaving vulgar notes for his colleagues, using bad language, having a poor work ethic and attitude, and abusing machinery. Several of his coworkers recalled that Cross had a violent temper and would throw objects and break things. Generally, others stayed away from him. Investigators found that throughout Cross's life, he had few friends and was not close with his family. He was a volatile, violent loner prone to fits of rage that were often directed against women. In an odd occurrence, Cross was listed as a witness in a police report about a prowler. This was in Grafton, near Rex Nord Plastics, on September 26, 1985. Around 2 a.m., a female co-worker of Cross's arrived home from a tavern and noted that someone was lurking in the bushes outside her home. Suddenly, Cross appeared, saying that he had seen a man running away. Officials now believe that the man in the bushes was Cross, and any malevolent act he intended on carrying out was foiled when his target had called the police. Cross married in 1988, quit Rex Nord Plastics, and moved to Sheboygan with his wife. That year, he was arrested in June for theft and criminal damage to property. In September 1991, he was interviewed by police in connection with an attempted rape. Cross had accepted a ride home from a woman he met at a tavern in Sheboygan. While she was driving, Cross took off his belt and suddenly tried to strangle her with it. The woman was extremely lucky to get away, and she called police on Cross. When they picked him up, he admitted he was involved but gave a different version of events. Smooth-talking Cross wriggled his way out of an arrest in that incident, but his would-be victim said she didn't know what had triggered him, and she was certain that he would have killed her if she hadn't gotten away. I reviewed Cross's arrest records for the years 1988 to 2012. It shows a disorganized, volatile, and violent criminal who was just lucky to escape justice for so many years. Part of the reason he eluded being fingered for Tracy's murder is that none of his crimes rose to the level where they would require that his DNA be submitted into CODIS. Over the years, Cross became more and more unstable and had numerous run-ins with the law. During the time period spanning the years 1992 to 2004, police responded to his residence on at least 15 occasions for domestic disturbances in which Cross was verbally and physically abusive to the women in his life and was responsible for multiple property damages. There were allegations that he sexually assaulted a 15-year-old girl, and he was a drug and alcohol abuser. In 1995, Cross and his wife Tammy divorced, and he was cited numerous times for income withholding, failure to pay alimony and child support. Yes, he had children. Then in 97, Cross was arrested for possession of cocaine and drug paraphernalia. In September 2002, another arrest, this time for OUI, operating a vehicle with a revoked license, and obstructing a police officer. This operating without a license misdemeanor would be repeated by Cross over and over again in 03, 07, and 08. In December 2002, he was also arrested for a hit and run with injury, as well as driving without a license. In 2003, he was arrested for disorderly conduct and resisting a police officer and charged with habitual criminality. He appears to have declared bankruptcy in 2008, and in February 2009 was arrested for operating a vehicle without a license, bail jumping, and possession of coke and THC. His penultimate arrest for OUI was in November 2011. By this time, Philip was estranged from much of his family, which he had alienated thanks to his lifestyle and life choices. He had one daughter who stood by him, but that's it. In August 2012, an arrest warrant was issued for Cross out of Milwaukee on charges that he made threatening remarks to hospital staff over the phone. His girlfriend at the time was in the hospital, and Cross made multiple calls to the facility where he became belligerent because he was not allowed to see her, probably because he was abusive. Before the warrant could be served on him, Cross died in the motel in Milwaukee that same month. His daughter had dropped him off at the motel, probably so he could hide out from the arrest warrant. So as you can hear, Philip Cross was a thorn in the side of Wisconsin law enforcement for years. But none of his subsequent crimes after Tracy amounted to anything close to murder. Although investigators believe he likely sexually assaulted other women, at least as far as they know now, Tracy was Cross's only murder victim. And they believe they know exactly what likely happened the night Tracy died. Cross got off work at midnight on that Friday night, December 14, 1984. His route leaving Rexnord Plastics in Grafton could have taken him on the road that Tracy was believed to have set out on to walk west from Port Washington to her home in Saukville, if he drove north to Saukville and then turned east toward Port Washington. He likely saw Tracy walking on the dark roadway and pulled over and offered her a ride. Tracy's family said she never would have accepted a ride from a stranger, but Sheriff Johnson says she was known to hitchhike, and furthermore, Philip Cross wasn't a stranger. Cross had grown up in the same town as Tracy and her family. Tracy's brother Rick told investigators that he remembered riding the school bus with Cross. Tracy rode the bus with him too when she was still a middle schooler. They knew him. Rick recalled Cross as the type of kid who picked fights and bullied people. Kids were scared of him and stayed away from him. Yet, in a shocking turn of events, Rick Hammerberg ended up renting a space in a Sheboygan duplex Philip Cross owned after Cross killed Rick's sister. And Cross was living there at the time as well. Yes, the killer and his victim's brother shared a living space unbeknownst to Rick. You have to wonder how Cross lived with himself, much less Rick, hiding his guilty secret all the while. Investigators do not know whether Cross and Tracy interacted at all in the time frame before Tracy was killed. Police could not find any link between Cross and the young men Tracy was hanging out with at Matt's house on that Friday night in 1984. But they moved in the same social circles and party scene, although Cross was more on the fringes. Another question that has never been answered is how Tracy and Philip ended up in the Sorakis driveway. The house is not somewhere someone would go if they didn't know of it. It is in the opposite direction of Cross's home in Port Washington, and it is south of Saukville, so Tracy would not have been walking in that area on her way home. But Tracy did know the Sorakis and had likely been to parties in their home in the past. It's unknown whether Philip had ever been there, although young people were known to gather and party at a nearby quarry. Perhaps in the dark, Cross mistook the driveway for the dirt road to the quarry. In any event, investigators' theory is that at some point, Cross either attacked Tracy or became enraged when she rejected his sexual advances. He strangled her and raped her. Then he discarded her in the driveway after bludgeoning her to death and drove off with his headlights off to avoid detection. And that leads to yet another unanswered question. Where were Philip and Tracy and what were they doing from the time she was last seen around 12:30 a.m. and when he killed her and drove off around 5:45 a.m.? Bars in the area closed at 2:30, and no one ever reported seeing the two together in public. Were they in the car for all those hours? This was why investigators held back the information about the male blood under Tracy's nails. It showed that she had fought back against her attacker, so it voided a potential defense by the perpetrator that their encounter had been consensual. One more thing that ties Cross to Tracy Hammerberg. Cross was known to smoke Marlboro Reds, the brand of cigarette that was found next to Tracy's lifeless body. Investigators believe that even though the two knew each other, Tracy's murder was a crime of opportunity. If Philip Cross hadn't been driving around after work that Friday night, Tracy would probably be alive today. When investigators called Tracy's family to tell them about Philip Cross, Jen and Rick were not all that surprised. Lori Sell, Tracy's other sister, said that she was angry that she didn't get to say her piece to her sister's killer. She told WITI she was very thankful that authorities never gave up on her sister's case and finally brought them some closure. She said, quote, "I know that Tracy is up there and she is looking down on all of us and she is happy with us. I never, ever have stopped thinking of my sister. I also think what she would be like today. She would have been an awesome aunt to my daughter, Rebecca. She was one of the nicest people that anyone could know." Sadly, Tracy's mother and stepfather were both deceased and died not knowing who had killed her. Sheriff Johnson said at the press conference that investigators were disappointed that they would never get the opportunity to prosecute Philip Cross for the murder of Tracy Hammerberg. They felt that they had a very strong case against him, and we have seen convictions on less evidence, such as in the case of Terrence Miller and Jerry Burns. But of course, by the time investigators knew who he was, Philip Cross had been dead for 7 years. Sheriff Johnson told WITI, quote, "I wanted to face Tracy's murderer. We didn't have that opportunity. He was able to live his life afterwards. He had children. Tracy didn't have that opportunity. He stole that from her." After 35 years, Tracy Hammerberg's case is finally closed thanks to forensic genealogy. And if you are one of the bad guys, they are coming for you. Many thanks to Ozaukee County Sheriff Jim Johnson for speaking with me about this case. Thanks for listening to this episode. Now I'm going to play for you a preview of a podcast I think you'll really like called The Frozen Truth.
Well, my name is Scott Fuller, and I have a podcast called Frozen Truth. And I go to where a mystery is, and I try to figure out what happened, basically.
Coming up in Season 4 of The Frozen Truth podcast.
And the car is the first thing that draws you into this case. The car is open. The doors are not locked. The key is still in the ignition.
We need to find out why this detective thought the most likely scenario was this woman parked her car and drowned herself and her 5-year-old son in a river.
Where are the bodies? I mean, that was my first thought.
Because there have been no clues that she staged her disappearance or was abducted.
Now, I don't know for sure that this record is missing. I mean, my antenna's up now. I'm very interested. I'm Scott Fuller. Please join me for a new season of Frozen Truth, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
DNA ID is researched, written, and hosted by me, Jessica Betancourt. It's produced by me and Mike Morford of Abjack Entertainment. Music composed by Connor Betancourt. To contact us, you can email the podcast at dnaidpodcast@gmail.com or follow us on social media. You can find us at dnaidpodcast on Instagram, at dnaidpodcast on Twitter, and on Facebook at dnaidpodcast. Check out our other collaborative podcasts, Scene of the Crime and Missing Persons.